Good evening, everyone. We will be in Psalm 34 to begin, the 34th Psalm. This week, as we've been talking about how the Old Testament scriptures often provide prophecy or imagery about the lives that we live, tonight's lesson is going to be more about how the Old Testament sometimes shares history or the life of someone that looks a lot like our life, perhaps. You know, everyone who's ever tried to live for the Lord has learned hard lessons in their life. Haven't every one of us in this room that have tried to serve God at times broken our own hearts and let ourselves down and made mistakes or committed sins that really troubled us? And we had to learn from those things and grow through those things. We're going to tell a story tonight about David, and then we're going to talk a little bit about Peter. And as was mentioned, the lesson is David, Peter, and me, or David, Peter, and you. And so I want you to be thinking about some of those things with me. Notice in Psalm 34, there's a superscription there right underneath the chapter that says this is a psalm of David when he feigned madness before Abimelech, who drove him away and he departed. There's a story in 1 Samuel 21 that we're going to go look at in a moment where David feigned madness or pretended to be crazy in front of Achish, the king of Gath. Now, you'll notice here it says Abimelech. Abimelech is a title, like kind of like the word Pharaoh, but like the Pharaohs would describe the Egyptian kings, the Abimelechs were the kings of the Philistines. So the specific king was named Achish, king of Gath, but that word Abimelech is just sort of a generic term. I will tell you before we read this psalm that there have been in history scholars who doubted that description. They'll say, I don't think David wrote this psalm on that occasion. And here's how they'll reason. They'll say, it doesn't make sense that David would write a psalm thanking God for deliverance when the way that he was delivered was ungodly and cowardly and less than noble. David was dishonest and got out of trouble. How could he be praising God for deliverance if he was doing it in an ignoble way? That's their argument. I don't think that's right. I think it makes perfect sense that David would write a psalm like this, but I'm going to nuance it a little bit. He's not just thanking God for deliverance from the king or from the Abimelech. He's thanking God for deliverance from his own failure and his own trouble, but we'll see that here in a minute. I'm going to read this, but I want to tell you there are two other psalms that, according to the superscriptions, we're around the same time in David's life. There's Psalm 34, there's Psalm 56, and I might make reference to that once or twice. And then there's Psalm 142. So Psalm 34, Psalm 56, and Psalm 142 all seem to be written around this time in David's life where he pretended to be crazy, went to the cave of Adullam and spent time in that cave and wrote some songs about that occasion. All right. Let's go ahead and read the psalm. So I invite you to look at your Bible as I read. And as I read, I want you to look for something. I'll give you some homework here. Try to see what David was feeling inside when he wrote these words, and then we'll make some observations. I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul will make its boast in the Lord. The humble will hear it and rejoice. Oh, magnify the Lord with me. Let us exalt his name together. I sought the Lord, and he answered me and delivered me from all my fears. They looked to him and were radiant, and their faces will never be ashamed. This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all of his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and rescues them. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. How blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. Oh, fear the Lord, you his saints, for to those who fear him there is no want. The young lions do lack and suffer hunger, but those who seek the Lord shall not be in want of any good thing. Come, you children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. Who is the man who desires life and loves length of days that he may see good? Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. The eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and his ears are open to their cry. The face of the Lord is against evildoers, to cut off the memory of them from the earth. The righteous cry, and the Lord hears, and delivers them out of all their troubles. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted, and saves those who are crushed in spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. He keeps all his bones, not one of them is broken. Evil shall slay the wicked, and those who hate the righteous will be condemned. The Lord redeems the soul of his servants, and none of those who take refuge in him will be condemned. Now, I'm not sure what you think of that psalm, but it's beautiful in a whole bunch of ways. You might have even noticed kind of the reference there to Jesus in verse 20. John in John 19 will reference this verse and point out that the bones of Jesus weren't broken on the cross, and this is the idea behind that. But did you notice what I asked you to look for, what David was feeling as he wrote the psalm? Go back to verse 4. Look at the end of verse 4. He speaks of the Lord delivering him from all his fears. Again, he's not just saying, you delivered me from somebody, but you delivered me from my fears. Look down there at verse 6. My version says, this poor man cried. But the footnote for poor is afflicted, not just monetarily in poverty, but afflicted in his soul. He was afraid. He felt affliction. Look at the end of verse 6. He speaks of trouble in his life. Go over to verse 17. He speaks of the righteous crying. Again, he speaks of their troubles. Verse 18, who's the Lord near to? The brokenhearted and those that are crushed in spirit. And then finally in verse 19, many are the afflictions. Have you ever had a season in your life where those things were true? You were afraid. You were crushed in spirit. Perhaps you were grieving. Perhaps you were confused. And you needed the Lord's help in your life. And maybe even in those moments, you didn't always act the way you should. You let yourself down because of your grief or your trouble or your affliction. That's kind of what's going on in this story. But to make sense of this psalm, let's go back to the story in 1 Samuel 21. So turn with me, if you would, to 1 Samuel 21, and notice what was going on in the life of David as he wrote these words. If I was to ask you to think about the sin of David, David's shortcomings in his life, what's the first thing you would think of? Bathsheba, right? Bathsheba doesn't happen for quite a while, not until 2 Samuel, David's on the throne, and he commits those terrible acts with her and to hide it and all of the things that he did on that occasion. An awful thing for a man after God's own heart. But I'm going to suggest to you that some of the first cracks in David's character are seen here in 1 Samuel 21. 1 Samuel 21 is not a very good chapter for David. In fact, at the beginning of this chapter, he's running from Saul, and he goes to the priests and lies to them. He tells them that he's on a mission from Saul. He's not. He's running from Saul. And this is also an occasion that Jesus would comment on later on. Jesus would point out that on this occasion, David did something that wasn't lawful. He ate the consecrated bread. So it's kind of a strange scene for David as we're setting this up. But let me show you that I think David wasn't in his right mind here. Go down to about verse 8. 1 Samuel 21, verse 8 says, David said to Ahimelech, that's the priest, now is there not a spear or a sword on hand? For I brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's matter was urgent. That's a lie, by the way. Then the priest said, the sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah, behold, it's wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you would take it for yourself, take it, for there is no other except it here. And David said, there is none like it. Give it to me. Then David arose and fled that day from Saul and went to Achish, king of Gath. All right, so David's having this conversation with the priest. Again, he says, hey, I was in such a hurry on this mission from the king that I forgot my weapons. I mean, this is a man who's a warrior. Again, it's not truthful. Is there no spear here? Any sword you've got laying around in the church building? I mean, that's not typical, I suppose. And he says, well, over there in the corner behind the ephod is the sword of Goliath. Does David know this sword? A few chapters before this, he used it to cut off the head of the giant. And so David's like, that's a great sword, I'll take it. And he takes it, and then it says that he flees with the sword to Achish, king of Gath. Does anybody remember where Goliath was from? Where was Goliath from? Gath. Folks, he's not thinking straight here. You don't take the champion of Gath's sword that you used to cut off his head and drag it down into the very place that he's from and expect to not be noticed or to not be pointed out or something. But David's not really in his right mind here. Because look what happens when he gets down there about verse 11. Then the servants of Achish said to him, is this not David, the king of the land? Did they not sing of this one as they danced, saying, Saul is slain his thousands and David his 10,000s? David took these words to heart and greatly feared Achish, king of Gath. You know, back in those days, I don't think they had most wanted posters. Maybe they did, but I doubt it. Nobody had ever taken a picture of David and showed it around. So the question is how they recognize him, you know? Maybe the sword, but they've been hearing songs that are being sung, you know, across the border in Israel. These songs have hit the tops of the international charts. David is slain his 10,000s. And the servants of Achish say, hey, this is the guy that's been killing all the Philistines. Look again at verse 12. Let me ask you about verse 12. Does that sound like the David that you know? That David would greatly fear anyone. Don't forget, he's holding the sword of the giant. He wasn't afraid of Goliath. Why is he now afraid of Achish? Well, here comes Achish, verse 13. So David disguised his sanity before them, and he acted insanely in their hands and scribbled on the doors of the gate and let his saliva run down into his beard. Then Achish said to his servants, behold, you see the man behaving as a madman. Why do you bring him to me? Do I lack madmen that you've brought this one to act the madman in my presence? Shall this one come into my house? Chapter 22. So David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's household heard of it, they went down there to him. Everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, everyone who was discontented gathered to David, and he became captain over them. Now, there were about 400 men with him. Now, let's try to get into this. David's afraid. Here comes the king. And his best idea is, don't look like King David. Don't look like the anointed of God. So he starts drooling down his beard. Would you guys like me to demonstrate that tonight? I've wondered if I should do that sometime, you know. Start babbling, mumbling, drooling, scribbling on the walls. I'm not sure how he did that. But when the king comes in and sees this crazy guy, he looks at the servants and he says, something almost kind of funny. I think this is kind of funny. Why are you bringing me more crazy people? I've got plenty of crazy people around here. You guys quit bringing me crazy people. Get this guy out of here. It's funny. By the way, is there something about what David's doing right now that's kind of clever? Is it smart to avoid notice by acting like you're insane? For sure. But let's get into David's heart for a minute. Do you think he was proud of himself? Do you think he thought he was clever and that this was a funny situation? What do you think? Man after God's own heart? Wiping the drool away and... My thought about this, when you get to chapter 22, I read into chapter 22 because it says that David went from there to this cave. And it sounds like, if you read it, that it took a little while for anybody to show up. In fact, the other psalm, Psalm 142, seems to be David praying in the cave that nobody's around him. And later on, some people come to be around him, almost like an answer to that prayer in Psalm 142. But think about David being in that cave by himself. Have you ever done something in your life that at the end of the day, when you laid your head down on the pillow, you just knew you'd done the wrong thing? And your conscience bothered you and you felt guilty about it. You ever had a moment like that? Let me suggest to you that Psalm 34 is actually kind of a psalm of repentance. Not just a psalm of deliverance. Listen to the first words of Psalm 34 again. I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise will continually be in my mouth. Or in other words, I'm never going to do that again. You're never going to find me in a situation where I'm going to deny God, deny who I am, pretend to be somebody else. I believe what's going on here is David has come to his senses about what's gone on. Now, also, notice it says that in chapter 22, verse 2, 400 men come to be with him, but the Bible describes them as all those distressed and in debt and discontented. I call it David's 3D army because of the 3D words. A merry band of losers, right? By the way, this might be foreshadowing. Later on, the son of David, Jesus, he'll be the rightful king, just like David is the rightful king, but he's not recognized as such by his people. The rightful king of Israel will eventually show up, and nobody recognizes him except those that are in debt, distressed, and discontent. That's the only kind of people Jesus could get around him. So maybe in a way, David is foreshadowing the Messiah here. All right, but let's just pause for a minute. What do you think of this story of David? I mean, David, the man after God's own heart, a hero. We tell him stories to him, to our children about him, David and Goliath and all the other things. But here, he has been deceptive and cowardly. What do we make of this? So I want us to try to have compassion on David in this moment, by doing something that I don't think we do enough of. At least I don't do enough of this. I'm going to try to fast forward the story of David's life up until this point so that we can have a little bit of sympathy about what he's been going through. Go back to chapter 16, and we're just going to hit some highlights of the years leading up to chapter 21. Now, I have a request for you while we do this. Number one, I would like for you to remember that everything we're about to talk about is somebody's real life. It's not made up stories. David actually went through these things. And these things happened in sequence, like one thing after another. David had to go through these things. The second thing I'd like for you to do while you remember that it's a real story is I want you to think of a time in your life where everything was changing rapidly. Like life was coming at you like a million miles an hour. You ever had times like that in your life? And it was hard to kind of navigate everything. And it doesn't even really matter what the trouble was, whether it was difficulty, whether it was like new opportunities. But life was hard because of how crazy life got. And then I want you to compare your life to David's life. All right? That's what we're going to do. It all starts in chapter 16. Look at chapter 16 of 1 Samuel. Around verse 12. So, he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy with beautiful eyes and a handsome appearance. And the Lord said, "Arise, anoint him, for this is he." And Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward. And Samuel arose and went to Ramah. One day, David was out in the field. There was something going on at his dad's house. All his older brothers were there, but David wasn't invited. Until at some point, somebody came out and said, "Hey, David, they want you in the house." And so this little ruddy runt of the family comes wandering into the house. And across the room, there's a man standing there, an old prophet, judge named Samuel. And he walks over and dumps oil on David's head and says, "You're the next king of Israel." Have you ever had a day like that? You ever had a day like that? Does anybody know how old David was that day? Josephus says he was 10 years old. Josephus, the Jewish historian, a lot of times exaggerates. Most scholars think David was 15. But can you imagine being 15 years old and being told that you're the king of Israel in front of all of your brothers who've just been rejected? I mean, if I was that kid with my brothers, I'd have puffed my chest out and said, "Hey, fellas, you see what just happened here?" But that's David's young life. Now, to make this more complicated, he's anointed king at 15, but do you remember how long it was before he actually gets to sit on the throne? 100% of the years that he's lived. He doesn't sit on the throne until he's 30. So from 15 years old until he's 30 years old, he's the rightful king of Israel, unrecognized. Have you ever seen a Christian that is what is called underemployed? Do you know what I'm talking about? Some Christian graduates from college with a fancy degree, and they can't find the job they're supposed to have, and so they have to work like a different job. I've seen Christians in that situation, and they're frustrated. I mean, it turns their life upside down that they have to live like this. But again, can you imagine being a 15-year-old who's been told you're the king of Israel, and you got to wait like 100% of the life that you've lived? It's not just that. What job did David still have to do? Who was he still working for? Well, one was his father. He still had to be a shepherd. The next few verses make it even more complicated. In verse 14, it says that the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord terrorized him. So Saul starts going crazy himself. And do you remember how he could be calmed down when he was crazy? What calmed this savage beast? Music. Who was found to be the musician for this guy? David. All right, so you're 15 years old, you're a teenager, you're rightfully the king of Israel, but you're working for your dad as a shepherd. You also got this side gig playing music for the crazy king. I mean, David would have watched this all the time. And I have to tell you, it would have frustrated me to watch Saul losing his mind when I knew that that should be the place that I was sitting. I have kind of a weird theory that later on when David's in front of Achish, king of Gath, and he thinks, "How can I not look like the king of Israel?" He probably thought, "Act like Saul, act like Saul, act like Saul. Drool down your beard and scribble on the walls." But David has to watch this. All right. Is that complicated if you're a teenager? Go to chapter 17. The next thing that happens, I think, is even more complicated. Look there about verse 17 of 1 Samuel 17. Jesse said to David, his son, "Take now for your brothers an ephah of this roasted grain, 10 loaves, and these 10 loaves, and run to the camp to your brothers. Bring also these 10 cuts of cheese to the commander of their thousand. And look into the welfare of your brothers, and bring back news of them. For Saul and they and all the men of Israel are in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. I tried to imagine this conversation between David and Jesse. Jesse says to David, David, your brothers are warriors out there fighting. Did you catch that in verse 19? They're fighting against the Philistines. And you're just a kid, so would you be my runner and take some bread to them and take some cheese to the commander of the army and bring back news? Because I'm interested to hear what your warrior brothers are doing. And again, if I'm David and I'm hauling all of this stuff out to the battlefield, I'm frustrated about this. By the way, Jesse was wrong in verse 19. They were not fighting with the Philistines. Skip down to verse 24. When all the men of Israel saw the man, they fled from him and were greatly afraid. These men weren't fighting, they were fleeing. And when David gets to the battlefield, that's what he sees. He sees a bunch of cowards in the army shaking in their boots because this warrior across the valley is challenging them. Now get into his head for a minute. Would that trouble you if you were going to be the next king of Israel? This is the state of the nation. Have you ever seen a Christian that was going to take over their parents' business? Like they were going to inherit something from their father or their mother and they were going to sort of take over. And as they got closer to taking it over, they realized the thing was in shambles. The company was in debt. Everyone hated their job. Morale was low. And they were being handed like this ball of yarn to untangle. You ever seen that? Would that stress you out? Imagine being a teenage boy, seeing all of this, and having to deal with the stress of that. Now, if that's not hard enough, David starts asking some questions about, hey, what will be done for the guy who kills this giant? Skip down there to about verse 28. 1 Samuel 17, 28 says, Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men. And Eliab's anger burned against David, and he said, why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your insolence and the wickedness of your heart, for you've come down in order to see the battle. But David said, what have I done now? Was it not just a question? Did any of you grow up in a family where your siblings hated you? I mean, maybe they even talked to you like this. Who do you think you are? Trying to make all the rest of us look bad. Why don't you just go back to where you belong? We have some Christians up in Minnesota that when they became Christians, this is exactly how their family talked to them. They would just ask questions, biblical questions. Hey, what does the Bible say about how we should worship? What does the Bible say about how we're saved? And their, quote, religious families would talk to them just like this. Who do you think you are? You're trying to make us look bad. Why don't you shut your mouth and go back to where you belong? By the way, if that was you, would that be hard for you? I mean, I'll introduce you to some people whose hearts are still broken about that kind of thing. That's David's life. Is it getting complicated yet for you? You know, I think the next thing that happens would have been my downfall. The next thing that happens is he kills the giant. But can I tell you why that would have been my downfall? Go to chapter 18 and look at verse 6. 18:6 says, it happened as they were coming when David returned from killing the Philistine, that the women came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, joy, musical instruments. The women sang as they played and said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. Then Saul became very angry for this saying displeased him. And he said, they've ascribed to David 10,000s, but to me they've ascribed thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom? Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on. All right, here's a question for the men. Would it have been hard for you if you were a teenager and you hadn't been recognized among your family, your brothers, a whole bunch of people that should have known you were something. And then one day, you go from zero to hero in the whole nation. Would that have affected you? If you became the most famous guy in the nation, would it have challenged you? And not just that, did you guys catch it? Who's coming out and singing about you? All the women. You ever seen a Christian kid become captain of the football team at his own high school? And he starts getting attention? That's enough to ruin some kids. But for David to now be famous, and women singing, and so famous that the king is jealous and looks at him with suspicion, is that a pressure in a young man's life that would be hard to face? But you know what I love about David? He doesn't seem to misuse it. He doesn't become a womanizer. He doesn't lift himself up. He doesn't just take control. He seems to be humble, doesn't he? All right. Look at verse 10 now. Chapter 18, verse 10. Now it came about on the next day that an evil spirit from God came mightily upon Saul, and he raved in the midst of his house while David was playing the harp with his hand, as usual, and a spear was in Saul's hand. Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, I will pin David to the wall. But David escaped from his presence twice. Have you ever had a day like that, where you went to work and your boss tried to shoot you? You've not had a day like that. And if you did, you didn't go back to work again so that he could try to shoot you again. But try to get into David's head for a minute. The second time he ducked the spear and he's running out of the room, do you think he could have thought something like this? God, what's going on in my life? I mean, ever since Samuel dumped oil on my head, nothing's going the way that I expected. And none of this makes any sense. What do you want me to do here, God? What am I supposed to do? This man is trying to kill me. Have any of you ever had your boss try to shoot you? And then look at verse 17, say something like this. Saul said to David, here's my older daughter, Merab. I will give her to you as a wife. I mean, you just tried to kill me and you want me to marry your daughter? All right, let's get into David's head. What would a man after God's own heart start doing if he knew he was going to get married? And by the way, he plans to marry Merab. What would a man after God's own heart do when he's getting ready to get married? Think he'd prepare for that? Get his heart right? Read all the right books? How many of you had this happen to you on your wedding day? Look at verse 19. It came about that at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given to Adriel the Maholathite for a wife. Did any of you get ready to marry your bride or your husband? And when you walked down the aisle, you got to the end of the aisle, and they were marrying the best man or the best woman? Would that have been hard on your heart? I've seen Christians have an engagement fall apart, and it messed them up for years and years. But that's just one more thing in David's life. Now, if that's not weird enough, verse 20 says that Michal, the sister of Merab, loved David. David had feelings for her. And so they talked to Saul, and Saul says, you know what, that's a good idea. You can marry Michal today. Folks, I'm glad I didn't live back then, because that's just weird. In fact, I've tried to, picture this. Saul says to David, okay, I know I gave Merab to somebody else. You can have Michal, though. But before you have Michal, you've got to give me a dowry, and it's 100 Philistine foreskins. That's not what I'm prepared to do on my wedding day. But that's what David's going to do. Go collect them. So David comes out of the bridegroom chamber. There's all his buddies. Hey, David, this is a great day. You're marrying Merab. He's like, no, I'm marrying Michal. They're like, no, we got the invitation right here. It says Merab. And he's like, no, plans have changed. It's Michal. But we've got some work to do, fellas. Let's go. And they go out, and double the order. They come back with 200 Philistine foreskins. And now look at verse 29, chapter 18, verse 29. Then Saul was even more afraid of David. Thus, Saul was David's enemy, what? Continually. Did any of you get married, and the day you got married was the day that your father-in-law or your mother-in-law hated you forever? Did that happen to you? You know, if I was watching this as a movie, and I'd watch this teenage boy go through all these things into his 20s, you know what I would hope would happen in the movie? Is that David and Michael would get married, they love each other, maybe they could move to the suburbs, get a little bit of space from all the nonsense, settle down, have a nice life. Wouldn't that be good? Is that what David gets? Go to chapter 19, verse 11. Then Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him in order to put him to death in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, if you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you'll be put to death. So Michal let David down through a window, and he went out and fled and escaped. Again, I don't know what this sounded like, so let me speculate. David falls down on the bed, the couch that night, tilts his head and looks at Michal and says, Michal, I love you. And she says, I love you. I'm excited to be with you. This is going to be great. Life's been really weird up until today. And about that time, Michal looks out the window and she turns back and looks at David and says, David, you've got to go. I don't want to go. Well, I don't want you to go, but you got to go. How long am I going to be gone? I don't know. Will I ever see you again? I'm not sure. And he crawls out a window into the darkness. And I don't know if he turned back and saw Michal in the window with tears streaming down her face. But have you ever wondered, what did David have left? Where was he going to go? You know, everything's okay if you have a best friend, right? If you have a best friend, you can kind of go through anything. Did David have a best friend? What was his name? Jonathan. Is that complicated? It is, because that's Saul's son. So David and Jonathan come up with an agreement. Jonathan says to David, I'm going to find out if dad really wants you dead. I mean, you know how he kind of loses his mind sometime. Give me 3 days. And in 3 days, I'll have it figured out whether dad wants you dead. So 3 days from now, go hide next to the archery range. And I'm going to come out with a young boy, and I'm going to shoot some arrows. And when I send the boy out to get the arrows, if I say to the lad, go further, young man, go further, like the arrows are further out in the field, then David, you've got to run away because dad wants you dead. But if I say to the young man, come closer, young man, come closer, as if the arrows are closer in, then the coast is clear. You can come home. All right, let's hide with David next to the archery range. It's been a long couple of days waiting for this news. And here comes Jonathan and the boy, and he shoots some arrows, and he sends the boy out. What are you wanting to hear? What are you wanting to hear? Come home, come closer. But as the boy is walking out, Jonathan pulls a bow, and he shoots an arrow as far as he can shoot it. And he says, go further, young man, go further. Remember how Psalm 34 says, the Lord is near to those who are crushed in spirit. Remember that? Do you think David was crushed that day? Look at chapter 20, verse 41. When the lad was gone, David rose from the south side, fell on his face to the ground, and bowed 3 times. And they kissed each other and wept together, but David wept the more. And again, I'll suggest to you, David wept the more because David had nowhere else to go. nowhere to turn. Complete confusion in his life. So when we get to chapter 21, which is the next chapter, do you blame him? Do you blame him for just having a bad day one day and saying, you know what, I'm just going to lie. I'm going to eat the consecrated bread. I'm going to say whatever I need to say. I'm so tired of doing the right thing. Going into the land of Gath, and when, you know, this man comes in and you're scared and you're tired and you're done the right thing all your life, do you blame him for just one day just saying, can't I be somebody else today? Can't I just let loose? Can't I just drool down my beard for a while? You ever had a time like that in your life? Where everything you'd always done right didn't seem to be working out. And the day came where you finally just broke your own heart. You just got so tired of it all that you did what you shouldn't have done. If you've ever been there, you've been where David was. Go back to Psalm 34. Let me show you something else that I think he was trying to do in the psalm. This psalm is not just a psalm of repentance or deliverance. It's a psalm of teaching. It's didactic. Look at verse 11. Psalm 34:11 says, come, you children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. Not the fear of man, but the fear of the Lord. By the way, did David have children yet? Did he have any children yet? We just sort of told the story. He didn't yet. Who could he be talking to? As a patriarch to children, to teach something. Remember those 400 in the cave? I'm going to suggest this could have been those men. He's their patriarch. He's their captain. He says, listen, children, you've come to me to learn something. Here's my question for you. Verse 12. Who is the man who desires life and loves length of days, that he may see good? Do you think if they raised their hands, do you think every man raised their hand? I want to love life and see good days. I want to have length of days. Teach me, David, how do I love life and see good days? Here's the answer, verse 13. Keep your tongue from evil, your lips from speaking deceit. Depart from evil and do good, seek peace and pursue it. Wait, that's it? Just don't tell lies? Keep your tongue from evil or your lips from speaking deceit? You know, in context, what was the deceit or the lie that David had told? It had to do with his identity, who he was. He denied being the anointed of God. And David here is trying to help these guys understand that if you want to love life and see good days, you don't want to do that to yourself. You don't want to break your own heart by denying who you are. I think that's part of what's going on in this psalm. But let's finish the lesson. This sermon is David, Peter, and us. Do you recognize verses 12 through 15 or 16 from the New Testament? Do you recognize that section? It's actually written in 1 Peter chapter 3. In 1 Peter chapter 3, Peter, in the middle of his letter, quotes Psalm 34. If you look at 1 Peter 3, verse 10 through 12, the one who desires life to love and see good days must keep his tongue from evil, his lips from speaking deceit. You see Peter, quoting David here. But let me ask you, would Peter have identified with this story at all? Had Peter ever feigned madness to deliver himself from a difficult situation? You remember it, don't you? The night that Jesus was betrayed, Jesus had told Peter, Satan has demanded permission to sift you like wheat. And you're going to deny me before the rooster crows. Remember, Peter said, I'll never do that. I mean, it's kind of like David in the sense that David was so brave against Goliath, but such a coward before Achish. Peter, in the Garden of Gethsemane, drew a sword and tried to kill a guy, cut off his ear. You remember that? Jesus put the ear back on and said, put your sword away. And it wasn't just but a few hours later that Peter found himself around a soldier's fire, and a little girl brought him down by saying, you're surely one of them. And what did Peter do? He cursed, and he swore, and he denied who he was and whose he was and the Lord, just like David had done. Is it any surprise that both Peter in Psalm 34, David in Psalm 34 and Peter in 1 Peter 3 want to teach us the same lesson? Life gets hard. You get tired. Things get difficult. The devil sometimes sifts you like wheat and you're being thrown around. But do you know what really is going to ruin your life? It's not the persecution that comes from the outside. It's the difficulty that comes when you break your own heart in this. I wish I would have known this lesson when I was younger, before I did this to myself more than once. Look at 1 Peter 3, verse 13. Right after he quotes the psalm, 1 Peter 3, 13, he asks this question. Who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? You ever tried to answer that question? Who's there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? You know what most Christians think? Everybody. I mean, if we keep teaching the truth, we might lose our jobs. People might hate our guts. We might get to a time in this country when the government will come down hard on us because we believe this Bible and preach the things in it. We could lose our freedom. We might lose our life someday. What do you mean, who is there to harm us if we prove zealous for what is good? Everybody could harm us if we try to do what's right. In fact, let's go whisper it to David in front of Achish, king of Gath. Hey, David, who's there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? You know what he would have said? Achish, king of Gath. Hey, Peter, who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? He could have pointed at the Romans and the Jewish Sanhedrin. They could put me on a cross next to the Lord. What do you mean, who is there to harm me if I prove zealous for what is good? But do you catch what he's actually asking? What's the worst they could do to you? So if Achish that day decided to take David's head off, and his head rolled to a stop, and David appeared before God, would God have said something like, how ashamed I am of you? Why are you here so early? What have you done? Why didn't you lie in that moment to deliver yourself? Or would have God maybe said something like, well done, good and faithful servant. You didn't let anybody scare you. If Peter had been hung on a cross next to Jesus that day because he said, I love that man, I follow that man, I'm one of his people, do you think God would have been disappointed in David if his life would have been taken? Do you remember what Jesus said? Do not fear those that can destroy the body. I don't know what life's going to be like for our children and our grandchildren coming up in the next few decades. But you know what I want them to remember? That if they're going to love life and see good days, they need to keep their tongue from evil and their lips from speaking deceit. They need to be willing to say they belong to the Lord. God will watch all of it and feel all of it alongside of them. In fact, that other psalm, Psalm 56, one of the cool things David says in that psalm is, God, you've taken account of my wanderings. You've kept every tear of mine in a bottle. Are they not in your book? David knew that God had been watching all of the difficulty of his life, saving his tears in a bottle. But you know what else David said in Psalm 56, verse 11? He said this, listen, in God I have put my trust. I shall not be afraid. What can man do to me? And if the day ever comes where you feel like your life's being threatened because of who you are or whose you are, here's what I want you to remember. Both David and Peter would teach you this. They can't ruin your life. They can't make it so you don't love life and see good days. The only thing that will make you not love life and see good days is if you start breaking your own heart by pretending to be somebody you're not. And if all of God's people can learn that, we'll be just fine in the future. God will be glorified, and people will know who he is. Thanks for your attention. We're out of time. I hope that story means something to you. I hope you can see your life in it. But I appreciate your attention tonight. We're going to sing a song that's meant to encourage. If you need our prayers or any help from us tonight, let us know while we stand and sing.